This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
Like the kōkako, the saddleback, or tieke, belongs to the New Zealand wattlebird family, a family to which the huia belonged and which has been established in this country since ancient times, much longer than most of our other birds. The saddleback takes its name from the bright reddish saddle on its back, which according to legend is the mark of Maui's hand. Sadly, this attractive bird has disappeared from the main islands and exists only on a few offshore islands, carefully chosen locations for resettlement away from predators, which appears to have saved the tieke from total extinction.
Community or chaos? We can construct and nurture community or fall into chaos. Over the next hour, Marvin Hubbard hosts conversations toward creating a fairer, more equal society.
Community or Chaos is made possible with the support of Quakers Aotearoa. You'll find them online at quaker.org.nz.
Good morning, friends. It's good to be with you. We're having Dr. Peter Thompson of the Better Media organization coming and talking with us about the media, and we'll be discussing the crisis in journalism and the crisis in democracy and how exposing corrupt patterns of influence is as important in New Zealand as it is overseas. Welcome, Peter.
Good morning, Marvin. Thanks for having me on again.
Peter, could you very briefly talk about the Better Public Media Trust?
Yeah, we've got an interesting, slightly convoluted history. We really stemmed from the Save TV NZ7 campaign back in 2011. For listeners who don't remember, TVNZ7 was one of TVNZ's new digital channels that was commercial free and had a wide range of programs that none of the other commercial media would touch. I mean, there were programs on politics, you know, the programs on the media, the programs on arts and culture and literature, you know, stuff that you'd never see on a commercial schedule. And the funding that had been given under Labour ran out, and the new national government decided it didn't want to carry it on. And we thought that was a terrible shame. So between a group of academics and a group of, you know, concerned industry practitioners, you know, we kind of launched this campaign. We had meetings around the country. You know, that ended up with marches down Queen Street and up to the Beehive. You know, there was quite a groundswell of public support. It didn't make any difference. They didn't fund it and it closed. But from that, we decided that there was a good fight to be fought. And we formed what we then called the Coalition for Better Broadcasting. And, you know, we made various public comments on media issues, you know, challenged government policy, you know, whether it was Labour or National, if we thought they were going in the wrong direction. And eventually we became aware, probably around 2016, when there were quite a lot of debates around the proposed merger between NZME and Fairfax, and, you know, the two big newspaper groups, which we thought was a bad idea because it would have created one virtual monopoly. That we were kind of stuck because we called ourselves Coalition for Better Broadcasting, but clearly digital media were on all platforms. And so we revised our name, became the Better Public Media Trust. And since then, to cut a long story short, we went through a rather long legal process arguing that we should be recognized as a charity because our function was partly educational, and that we engaged the public in important debates, and that public media was in fact something that was generally beneficial to the community. And the Charities Commission didn't agree at first, but eventually the courts ruled we were right. And so we're now a registered charity, even though we do engage in advocacy for, as the name suggests, better public media.
Well, that's one of the interesting things. A lot of good charities do advocate.
Absolutely.
Well, look at the the Presbyterian Support or Salvation Army, they advocate for the homeless. They advocate for
Absolutely.
the people they're serving.
Well, that we don't see that as any different fundamentally
I mean, it
from
seems to
Amish.
me that as part of the process, if you want
Well, we'd
change
like to
for the
think
better,
so.
you've got to say it.
Yeah. So, but we're not just an ideological group. When we look at the evidence, we weigh it up. We make pretty reasoned, we hope, submissions on public policy debates and select committee hearings. We try and talk to policymakers. We're not party political, so if policy is going in the right direction, we'll say, well, this is a good thing, regardless of whether it's coming from the political right or the political left. Although usually it's the political left that are more interested in progressing public media concerns. The political right's usually quite reticent about it, if not directly opposed in some cases. So that's our niche, and we do get consulted by the media, and occasionally we get consulted by government departments for our expertise. We have industry people on the board, and we also have some pretty credible academics, including the former Dean of Law at Canterbury, Ursula Chir, and new to our board, Maryam Elalati, who's really, really top-end media researcher from AUT University in Auckland. So we've got both industry expertise and academic expertise.
Could you briefly talk about the link between is there a crisis in journalism, and is the crisis in journalism and the growing mistrust in government and public institutions, are they linked?
I think they are. But there are separate crises. It's a
Yes.
poly crisis, if you like, for journalism. I mean, the first big picture, snap of this is that the platforms have captured a huge share of the digital advertising market, and you can plot the decline of advertising, over the last 20 years, and it's an inverse relationship with the growth of platform advertising. And it doesn't mean the platforms have stolen the news. I think that's a bit of a misunderstanding, but it certainly would suggest that there's been a shift in where the advertisers spend their dollars, because the platforms are so effective at grabbing our data and using that to target advertising at us. So ju just in the journalism sector, I mean, we've seen they used to have about a 30, 40% share going back 20, 25 years of the advertising spend. And now they're down, I think, to less than 10. So they've kind of lost over 75% of the advertising market that used to support them. We've seen over the last decade or so, various figures have been bandied around, but roughly half the journalists that used to be employed 15, 20 years ago are now not employed as journalists. They may well be employed by government departments. So that's the first part of the crisis. And the second part, I think this growing mistrust that you talk about, both in government and media and public institutions, I think there's always been a bit of a skepticism towards the media. I think that's generally healthy. I'm a media lecturer. The first thing we teach students is don't believe everything you read or see or listen to. But you can take that too far. And I think what we've seen, particularly since the COVID crisis, is a quite broad disenchantment in with public institutions and so-called mainstream media among a particular constituency of the population. And that's been fed, I think, by some malintentioned, mainly right-wing groups that want to foster mistrust in the media because they want their own sources of disinformation to gain prominence. So that sounds a bit like a conspiracy theory, but I think it's a tendency rather than an organized endeavor. But there's the groups that felt that the media didn't do a very good job of representing their skepticism towards the vaccine during the COVID crisis, or the groups that thought that the government was covering things up, and people have latched on to pretty nutty conspiracy theories, the plandemic, the idea that this was all some weird global conspiracy by Bill Gates, or, I mean, really, really nutty ideas out there. But some people have bought this. And once you go down that rabbit hole, it kind of becomes a whole lot easier to believe a whole load of other things, that the entire government is run by, global elites, whatever they are, or that there's, some kind of organized plan within the media, to avoid representing points of view that aren't legitimate. And so I think it's come from that there's, it's not everybody, it's certainly not all the time, but there's a constituency within the public who I think are broadly disenchanted both with the media and the mainstream, mainstream press, and also with the institutions of the state. And in some cases, they're right to be skeptical. But when it's wholesale cynicism, you just don't believe anybody, and you go to increasingly nutty and extreme sources for your information, I think that's kind of dangerous.
One of the things that I've looked at in the past was the anti-vaccine demonstrations in parliamentary grounds. Remember
Oh yes, absolutely. My
that?
cousin was there. We had some interesting conversations.
Oh yeah, I had friends. You found you couldn't talk about vaccination, really. But what I was looking at was the people who participated in that were mainly from the back box of provinces. And one of the things that I'm aware of is that from the 80s on, small town New Zealand has suffered a lot. Has suffered, lost schools, lost pharmacies, banks, almost anything that makes a community run well. And
I
now,
think
with the price of power, these timber companies are closing down, another thing that will be felt on the heartland. So I think there's a lot of reason to be unhappy with the direction of so-called progress and the direction of government since the 80s.
I couldn't disagree with that,
I think
and
that's
I
where I think we have to look at that as well as. I mean, there are people who advocate extreme positions and they use this legitimate concern about the way society is going in a, maybe an illegitimate way, but.
Yeah, I think that's a valid observation, Marvin. And certainly, look, I mean, the COVID crisis, particularly with lockdown, hurt a lot of people. There's no two ways about it. I mean, some small businesses went under, particularly if you're, for example, in the restaurant trade, where people just couldn't go to your establishments at all. Other retailers lost ground and lost money, and some of them got driven out of business altogether. So sure, people are angry about that. Now, that's one thing, and if you feel bad about the way that the Labour led the response to COVID, well, I think that's an understandable position. But it's something else to leap from feeling, maybe legitimately disgruntled, to the idea that you can't trust any of the media, and that all the institutions of government are, corrupt and part of this grand conspiracy against you. I mean,
My point
that's.
is, if you have legitimate reason to feel disgruntled with the movement of inequality in New Zealand and other countries,
Yeah.
makes you more open to being persuaded by extreme movements. I mean, it's crazy to vote for somebody like Trump or ACT because you're experiencing inequality because they'll make the inequality worse. But
But
the
terrible
problem
irony.
is when people are have the experience of having feeling unrepresented for a long time and feeling that there's not much they can do about it, they are more likely to be irrational.
I think it possibly comes, and I'm not a social psychologist, and probably there may be other arguments that would be more sophisticated than the one I'm going to make here. But I think where you have a collective of people in society who have a, pent up frustrations. I mean, understandable frustrations, or feel aggrieved about the way they've been treated. It's quite difficult to articulate those concerns and express your frustration through a, the channels that actually might redress them, because it's multifaceted, it's complicated, it's all about, the interplay of different economic, social, and political systems. And most people really aren't experts in all of that. It's difficult even for, for someone who's relatively well educated and informed about these matters to explain it simply. And you give someone a target, you give them an enemy, you tell them it's not their fault, and you give them someone to blame, and you've created a lightning rod for that frustration and pent up anger. And on the way, the momentum of that frustration picks up all sorts of other flotsam and jetsam. So, it's kind of curious that the people who are talking about, well, we don't trust the media, or we're angry about the government, about lockdown, and end up all together around Parliament sharing ideas with vaccine protesters. And then you go and look at who's propagating some of these messages. And that's where I get kind of interested. Now, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but I mean, we can see, wealthy people on the right. Obviously Elon Musk would be an example. Takes over an entire social media platform, and basically allows anybody to share any kinds of ideas on there, even if they're self-evidently, incorrect or based on disinformation. And that's the concern that I have, because I think the way that they've tried to popularize distrust and cynicism about the mainstream media. Not that the mainstream media are perfect by any means, but the idea that you can't trust any of the news, and that the only news you can trust is coming from, these really quite extreme and potentially quite dangerous websites that are propagating disinformation. I think that's corrosive of
The
civil
problem with
society.
the platforms is they can be owned, and by us one person or a group of people, even a person like Musk, if you got enough money. And they're at the way it is now, there's no they can be as irresponsible as they want.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that ties in also with some of these very, very strong and vociferous arguments for so-called free speech. Because I don't think they actually believe in free speech, or the kind of free speech that would support a rational democracy, or deliberative participation by the public in politics. I think they want a free speech that basically means fundamental, deregulation, and the inability of government to stop the proliferation of disinformation. Because I'm a political economist, and so the first question I always ask if someone has a proposal is cui bono, who benefits, in whose interests do these, do these efforts, initiatives really function? And where you've got, individually wealthy people who are backing, disinformation campaigns. I think we have to be very skeptical about some of their messages. I mean, we've seen, we, I mean, there's here we've got, I mean, the Right family, interestingly, has just said it's not going to carry on funding the platform. I mean, in New Zealand, that's Sean Plunkett's gig. And I've been on the platform a couple of times, had some good arguments on it. Some of the things they do are actually kind of useful. Some of it, though, is obviously ideological. The same with the centrists. There's anti-vax stuff and disinformation on that all the time. Now, Jim Grenham was involved with the centrist, and that was the guy that just tried to do a, basically take over the board of the Herald, of NZME. So, I mean, he was stopped, but he's still there. Stephen Joyce has taken over. Whether that's an improvement, I don't know. But the potential for someone to go from effectively backing a right-wing conspiracy website, pretending to be news, to actually buying up the mainstream media. I think that's actually quite a terrifying prospect. You don't need to be a conspiracy theorist, to make those arguments. It's been in the news. It's documented.
What? I mean, I was sad to see the Marlboro Express, the paper end of it, closing. I think one of the things that about living in Dunedin, you can write a letter to the paper and it'll get in there.
I
And the Allied Press is fairly well trusted in Dunedin.
it's yeah, the Allied Press is perhaps the exception to the rule because it's relatively small, but it has a very loyal local holding. I mean, there are other local media as well that closed down recently. I was very sad to see that Crux Media had stopped operating. That was Peter Newport's independent digital news website. That was doing some really interesting, investigative journalism and some sorts of journalism that the ODT wasn't doing. But yeah, so when you lose these local media, I mean, to some extent, they may be compensated for by the national media. But even if the national media send reporters down to the regions, their angle on reporting is always framed by a concern to make the news relevant to the national audience. So not necessarily looking at it with local eyes. And so I kind of shed a tear every time I hear of a local publication going, because they have a feel for what's going on in the local area. They know the local people. They have a feel for the audience in a way that perhaps the national media don't really. And so I think that's a terrible loss. So there are some good initiatives. I mean, one thing that the current government has done, despite the previous protestations of some people in cabinet, notably Winston Peters, is local democracy reporting, which was supported by the Public Interest Journalism Fund and is now being continued. And that's a scheme with RNZ and New Zealand On Air, where they basically pay to put a local reporter on local government news beats. The o Open Justice is the other one that does the courts. So that can help, and that news, interestingly, is shared. So if you had a local democracy reporter seconded to the ODT, I mean, they wouldn't just report news for the ODT. That news would become available elsewhere. And there were some interesting ideas. I mean, Peter Newport from Crux had this proposal for a regional news network where a whole group of regional news providers would get together and kind of pool their news. And I thought that was a pretty good idea. So whether or not that's something that we could look to in the future, I don't know. I don't think there's any appetite from the current government to fund that kind of initiative, though.
Of course, I'm a fan of the online radio.
Yeah. Well, why wouldn't you be? It's and community access radio
That's what I'm talking
does
about.
some of the things that none of the other media will do, and there'll be things on or Dunedin that you would never hear on RNZ, including this interview.
One of the interesting people I really miss is Kim Hill.
Yeah.
I mean, we don't have the in-depth interviews as much as we used to.
I think that's probably true. I haven't seen a study of this, but I mean the trend towards increased superficiality, populism in the news started back in the really from the end of the 1980s. Joe Atkinson and Dan Cook and others were measuring, this was more on TV, but they were measuring the decline of hard news and the length of news items. We've seen this in current affairs on TV. The drift towards some more populist magazine chat shows. It's really like breakfast TV on in the evening rather than current affairs and analysis. There is still some, but the difficulty is, of course, that really good investigative journalism and in-depth news takes time and money. And a lot of the news media don't have that. And that's why public media, I think, are still incredibly important, whichever platform they're on.
And Nine the
Because
News
they're not
still,
worried about ratings and advertising.
Nine the News still does that to a certain extent.
Yeah. And in
But
the
probably our best news, public media right now is national radio.
I would tend to agree with that. I mean, they're not perfect, but they do a pretty solid job most of the time. I mean, what we don't have is a good international group of reporters. I mean, we rely inordinately on overseas news feeds for news from overseas. And so we tend to get a British or Australian or, American perspective on international affairs. I mean, don't get me started on the news coverage of Gaza, and the that's a bit of an issue. It has been for a long time, but this good example of where if you're relying on international news sources, and structurally we know that they get their news more readily from Israeli sources than Palestinian or Arabic sources, then you tend to replicate those biases in the news here. So and that would be partly a problem that we don't have the funds or the resources to send New Zealand reporters to all these zones. We do occasionally, but usually only if New Zealand is directly involved or if there's an All Blacks game.
Well, it's very expensive, I think.
It is hugely expensive.
Well, on the other
It's not
hand,
a
if you're
cheap
going to.
endeavor. And so if you're looking to cut costs, that's one of the first things you can sacrifice, because you can license you get, sign up to a license with one of the big global news providers, and get your news feed from them. And most of the time it will be good. But if there's a pro-American, pro-Western, pro-Israeli bias in the way that those global news media tend to work, and that's not necessarily saying that they set out to be like that. Institutionally, there are structural reasons why they tend to reflect the views of the global north, as you might say, rather than communities and cultures and religions that are perhaps less familiar to the West. You tend to get an oversupply of perspectives that reinforce that view of the world. I mean, Al Jazeera is maybe a good antidote to that, because they do take an alternative view of a lot of these things. But then you've got to make the effort to go and actually have a look at Al Jazeera. So I'd love to see a public media system that included funds for investigative journalism and actually had an international news team. They wouldn't be as big as the BBC or CNN, obviously, but just to have a New Zealand perspective on some of these things, I think, is incredibly important.
But probably if you're ever going to get that, you actually need a tax regime to collect taxes.
Well, you certainly need to fund it, and it's not going to be commercial. I mean, my proposal for this, and I've been bashing on about this idea for over a decade now, would be to implement a small levy across a wide range of commercial media revenue streams, and that would include digital advertising. It might include telecommunications. We already have a small levy on telecommunications. Nobody noticed and nobody rioted. But I also put a levy on audiovisual retail goods, computers, laptops, televisions, phones. I mean, that's a big market. And you if you put a small levy of a couple of percent on a range of these revenue streams, you could raise hundreds of millions of dollars. Now, we're still not going to get the BBC, but what you would get is sufficient funds for a very, very credible public service media, and enough to put funds into public journalism and basically revitalize journalism, even in the commercial media sector. Get them doing serious investigative journalism again. I thought the Public Interest Journalism Fund did a very good job, despite its very bad press and probably not very clever marketing by the government at the time. But things like that, I think, are essential if we're going to restore public trust in the media. Now, the challenge to that is some people don't trust any form of government funding for the media. And right now, partly because of the current inhabitants of the White House and his predilection for imposing tariffs for all kinds of capricious and irrational reasons, everybody's running scared of upsetting Trump, because and if you put a levy on digital advertising, he'd probably see that as a trade imbalance and hit us with more levies. I mean, Canada's already backed down. I mean, they had a digital services tax set up. It was actually legislation. They've removed it. I mean, that's not just cowardly, it's a surrender of sovereignty. And it's literally unbelievable that a country would change its law, because some guy next door was threatening completely irrational and unjustified, trade conditions on you if you didn't comply. And the UK has pulled away from its digital services tax. I look at this and I really can't believe it. I mean, Canada may as well have sold itself to the USA if it's going to do that and become state 51.
The problem is that people are just afraid of Trump. They're afraid that he'll get whacked with 50% tariffs, like Brazil. I mean, Brazil's
There's
got a 50% tariff because their courts decided when the ex-president of Brazil tried to have a
Bolsonaro, yeah.
military coup, Bolsonaro, the courts decided to try him for treason. When the same thing happened in the United States, they let it go, and that's one reason you got Trump again.
Yes.
But this is obviously why Trump doesn't like Barnes being prosecuted for his activities after the losing the election, because he knows that he should have been prosecuted. But
Well, maybe
he's
setting a
got
bad
50%.
example.
But Brazil's not giving in. The courts aren't giving in. And they've actually found that the popularity of the government for not giving in has gone up, even
They've gone
among
up, yeah.
the right.
Well, I think that there should have been a collective response to this. I mean, the fact of the matter is whether it's Trump's idea of creating such confusion and concern that people comply with him just in case he does something crazy, whether that's actually a deliberate strategy or not. I mean, he hasn't persuaded Europe to give up their digital services taxes. If you have a strong bloc and you say, look, guys, this isn't a trade imbalance. This doesn't make sense. If you hit us with tariffs, we're going to hit you with tariffs. And we're both going to lose, but you're going to hurt more because we're a bigger bloc than you are when we all get together. That's what I really would have hoped for. So to see countries like Canada and the UK capitulating, I'm just very, very saddened by that. Now, maybe easy for me to say in my ivory tower. I mean, if you were a small country and you were suddenly hit by incredible tariffs that put a huge hole in your export market and put people out of work, well, that would hurt. So I can understand why policymakers are playing safe. But on the other hand, if you're going to do that, then you show yourself to be weak and potentially vulnerable to manipulation. And I think that's a very, very weak and dangerous position to be in, geopolitically. It doesn't put us in a good light. And I always liked the fact that New Zealand went anti-nuclear, and stood up to the US and NATO, and basically said, you know what, you're not bringing your nuclear ships and weapons anywhere near here. You're staying out. So we were the mouse that roared on that point, and I think we should be again.
Yeah. Well, I'm disappointed that Canada gave in on that because
Yeah.
they actually need to stand up to the United States for obvious
Darn
reasons.
right. And it's not that they didn't have any leverage. They're a huge export market for the States. So this is the nature of international trade. And you can't put sanctions on your trade partners without hurting yourself. The sooner somebody talks sense into Trump, the better. But whether that's a possibility, I really don't know.
Well, I think that Trump likes to be on the winning side.
Yes.
I
See how
think.
many American factories have to close before he realizes he might actually be on the losing side.
Yeah. Well, does this make public funding for journalism even more necessary?
Oh, well, absolutely. I mean, the market can't provide it because, so much of the digital advertising has gone to the platforms, and they're not reinvesting. And from their own actions in Canada again and in Australia, they certainly show no signs of being willing to cooperate with news bargaining schemes. They made it pretty clear here in New Zealand that they wouldn't be very happy if the Fair Digital News Bargaining Bill went ahead, and that was the scheme whereby the big platforms would be required by law to enter into negotiations with the news media to compensate them for using the news. And for me, that was always based on a kind of a misdiagnosis of the nature of the relationship between the platforms and the news media. Because the news media were actually putting their news on the platform. So it kind of gets a bit hard to keep the argument going that somehow the platforms have stolen the news, or they ought to pay licensing fees. I think the bigger issue is their ad tech, and there are some very interesting arguments going on in the courts in the US at the moment. There's a big lawsuit going through with Google and its ad tech systems. It's been found guilty recently of basically abusing its market power over the way that online advertisers are effectively forced to use Google systems. And so there's an argument. But my argument's a lot simpler, and that is that they take our data, and the nature of their business models enables the proliferation of all sorts of harmful content online. And I think that they shouldn't just be compensating the news media, they should be compensating society. They should be paying us for using our data and selling us advertising and pushing disinformation.
Our problem is that every time we use Google, we give them information about ourselves,
You do, and
and
every time you log into social media.
there's no way we can really prevent this happening.
Yeah, well, I you could use an independent search engine like DuckDuckGo. They don't collect your data when you go searching for things. That's part of the appeal. But we need public interest, public service platforms. I mean, that's really what the ultimate goal here is, to have social media and search engines that work for the public and whose algorithms are accountable to the public. So it's not, and the thing is, part of this, I mean, we're not just looking at regulating the platforms to make them chip in to support public media, although I think that would be a good start. I think we need to go back to the Safer Online Services and Media Platforms proposal that was summarily rejected by Brooke Van Belden earlier in this government's term of office, because there were some very sensible ideas there, where the platforms could have taken steps to mitigate harms, to reduce the proliferation of harmful content and disinformation. And they weren't necessarily opposed to that. So the idea that you'd throw the opportunity to develop regulations in conjunction with the platforms, who don't necessarily want to inflict harm on society, they want to make money. But if there are regulations that actually are consistent with their profit motives, but also are consistent with civil society's need for protection, then they're not always unwilling to cooperate. So I think we need to go back and investigate those, because certainly we're well overdue a framework for regulating platforms and social media.
Do we need public-owned platforms?
I would love to see that. I don't know whether it's possible, because if you, I mean, it's what we call network incumbency. The part of the power of these networks is that so many people use them. Now, particularly with social media, I don't particularly like Facebook. I'm on LinkedIn, one or two other smaller non-commercial platforms, but the smaller non-commercial ones like Mastodon, the people I want to stay in touch with aren't all there. They're on Facebook. And the same would be true for other people on Twitter or Instagram. So unless you can manage a wholesale migration to a non-commercial platform, it's really, really difficult to implement. So I think we're kind of stuck with these network incumbents. But that for me means that they have to accept a social responsibility. And the same with Google as a search engine. I mean, they're responsible, something like 97% of online searches go through Google. It's an incredible level of market power. And so in a sense, they're a public utility. Now, if they become part of the fabric of society such that we can't really exist in the digital world without making use of their platforms and services, I think we have a very strong case to say, look, you're making such a huge amount of money. You have to accept some level of social responsibility here. And that means that we make some of the rules for you. That if you want to remain a public utility, a public utility in practice, then you have to open up your algorithms, let us check what they are, take steps to mitigate harms. And it, insofar as you've captured so much of the advertising, some of that is going to be returned to support the sorts of public media, and public service media production that isn't possible because you've taken all the advertising. For me, I mean, the shareholders won't like it and they might oppose it, but I think as a society, those arguments are valid. We can't just let them walk in and take over our digital social lives and indeed our digital politics.
That includes a small levy.
I would include a small levy. And, there's about, what, $2.2 billion of digital advertising at the moment in New Zealand. So even if you put a 1% levy on that, you'd be getting 22 million. You put a 3% levy. Austria's got a 5% levy. If you put that 5% levy on digital advertising, we'd be raising $100 million a year. Now, all of a sudden, that was about the level of funding that the Aotearoa New Zealand public media proposal to put TVNZ and RNZ together, would have needed. So that wasn't a perfect model, but it was certainly an ambitious model, and that kind of funding would be sufficient to create a very, very significant public media presence, and to support other commercial media that form part of the Fourth Estate and provide a public interest form of journalism. I think a small levy would work, and insofar as it gets passed on to the consumer, well, we didn't see any riots in the streets when the telecommunications d development levy was introduced. I mean, that was a levy on the telecommunications companies to support high-speed broadband and wireless in rural areas where you couldn't get fiber. Nobody even noticed it was there. And that was worth another $50 million a year. It's about 1%, on a $5 billion market. So you put all these things together, you get $200 million quite easily, and that's a game changing amount. From with that kind of funding, you could boost RNZ. You could probably save TVNZ that's slowly going into decline, and you could support public journalism. And you could do it independently so that there's no arguments about whether it's government interference, which was always rubbish, but that was the narrative that Winston Peters and others put out there. It was quite mischievous and completely misinformed.
I mean, actually, our history of broadcasting, particularly Radio New Zealand and so on, you don't have a history of strong bias.
It's well, in a way, I mean, all news has a perspective. I mean, you have to tell the news from an angle, but you can at least get the facts right, and you can at least make sure that there are standards that apply, such that you are required to reflect most prominent and relevant points of view. Now, that's where we get into a bit of an ideological debate because that there are. If you want to talk about, for example, vaccines or climate change, there are people who, believe that vaccines are all part of a big conspiracy or that climate change is a hoax. And I'm sorry, the science doesn't agree with them. You can prove empirically that those points of view are malinformed. And so, you know, you don't have to have balance where, you know, people who believe in a flat earth are on the same platform as NASA scientists. You know, that's not balance. That's a kind of an artificial representation of balance. But where there's legitimate dispute of ideas, I mean, that's where you hope that you get more than one perspective. Now, you know, if you don't like that, well, you can always find, you know, crazy stuff out there on the internet. But I would like to see some of the more dangerous sources of disinformation flagged and labeled so that you know what you're getting into. Facebook did that a while ago, where there was a, I forget which party it was. There was a small party, was it Advance, that was putting out, you know, vaccine skeptic messages. And Facebook actually labeled it and said, well, some of this is questionable, and here's a link to some reliable sources about vaccines. And I thought that kind of thing was responsible. So, you know, so balance, yes. I mean, should we reflect, you know, points of view that are slightly beyond the pale or out there? Well, I think in certain contexts, I think that's legitimate. But what I don't believe in is that that means that every single point of view, no matter how toxic or dangerous, should be given a platform. There are people who genuinely believe that the Christchurch terrorist manifesto and video should be freely available. And I really worry what their thinking is there, because clearly that's not healthy for society. And there's actual empirical evidence that the video and manifesto directly motivated future terrorist attacks in other countries, including the Buffalo shooter, who actually cited the Christchurch events and the manifesto as a motivation for taking that action. So there are things that clearly we want to ban, but there are also political and economic interests in having a free-for-all where fundamentally it's not free speech. It's just where the people with the deepest pockets have the loudest voices, and indeed, in some cases, are allowed to take over the media. Now, we've already seen what happens when you allow that, because we have Rupert Murdoch and Fox News, you know, and that's not the worst of it. I mean, there's things that are even worse than Fox News that don't even reflect actual events, that just make stuff up and put out. Well, yeah. I mean, you know, InfoWars and other kinds of really, really out there conspiracy sites that nevertheless have an audience and a constituency that want to believe that kind of thing. So, you know, I think if we had, you know, a new regulatory framework, I mean, people might be concerned about the government regulating the media. Well, okay, but there's a very important distinction to be drawn between the government regulating the media, as in the politicians that we've elected, versus having an independent statutory regulator where the board and the governors are appointed according to merit, not just because they happen to be a mate of the minister, and even to have citizens' forums. Now, the BBC had something like this, where they had a whole range of forums with viewers around the country who would comment on what they thought the BBC was doing well. And I think if we had an independent media commission that was you know, appointed at arm's length, that had statutory power but wasn't accountable directly to government of the day, and which would include a responsibility to engage with a wide range of communities within society, and that includes some of the out there ones. You know, I think that would help to re-engender a level of trust that's perhaps been lost. I mean, we know that some media are trying pretty hard to do this. I mean, RNZ, we know, has been told by the government that it's that they want to increase its trust, and it's now the most trusted media organisation in New Zealand, according to the polls. It comes in at just, I think it was just over 50%, which, you know, isn't necessarily good news, because it means that 50% possibly don't trust it. But efforts to engage the public, efforts to show that you're listening, and where people have points of view that are not represented, to actually have the issues that they're concerned about discussed, but discussed in an environment where you're bounded by the rules of rational debate and deliberation, and that the aim is to create understanding and meaning rather than fomenting a riot. I mean, I looked at the last year. I mean, and even this year, there were riots in the UK in Southport, quite near to an area where I was brought up in, and I was very upset because the riots against the Muslim community were triggered by disinformation online. I mean, there'd been a murder of some young girls at a dance party, a terrible event, and people were understandably furious and upset. But the disinformation online said that the person who committed it was a basically an asylum seeker, some come from overseas. Actually, they were born in the UK. There was, and they weren't Muslim. They'd been brought up by a Christian family. Funnily enough, that discussion petered out pretty quickly on right-wing websites. So triggering that kind of response, where there were riots in the streets and people being hurt and a community being targeted, is absolutely the kind of free speech we don't want. It's a bit like shouting fire in a crowded theatre. If people rush to the exit and get crushed, you're responsible for that, and you have to be held accountable. But if you can have a debate about contentious issues in a forum where there's reasonable debate, counterpoint, and the space to deliberate over evidence, and where people can actually see why some of the crazy ideas are misconstrued or based on a misunderstanding or a misreading of the evidence. I mean, should we be able to debate, vaccine safety? Yeah, I think that's a legitimate debate. I think the scientists are generally right. There's overwhelming evidence that vaccines are effective. Are they always safe? No. Sometimes they actually have dangerous or even fatal side effects. But from a public policy perspective, overwhelming and irrefutable evidence that they've saved millions and millions of lives. And now we're seeing measles pandemics because groups of people in society are saying, oh, I don't want the kids vaccinated. Maybe they'll become autistic, or maybe it's all a conspiracy. And their kids are getting ill. That's a terrible, terrible outcome for society. So should we be able to debate these issues? Yes, because if we don't, those people are going to flee to the dark web or the extreme, conspiracy websites for their information. But we don't just let it to be allow any ideas to be proliferated out there. It's got to be framed within a forum that supports, mutual understanding, rational debate, and understanding. What I would call, citing a German philosopher, Jürgen Habermas, the public sphere, which was the idea that we come together as a community, we discuss our differences, we discuss our ideas, and we come to a better understanding all around. And I think that's what we're missing,
I
in
think
our media system.
that's one of the tragedies of the last 30 years or so, is the shrinking of the public sphere.
Absolutely. And it's been fragmented. I mean, I think there's bits of a public sphere out there online, but it's not being brought together. People go down rabbit holes. I don't quite buy the arguments about echo chambers and filter bubbles, but there's certainly a tendency for people to go and look for sources of information that affirm their misunderstanding. And so and if they then cease to engage with mainstream, then that can be a problem for society. And I say that's corrosive of civil society, and it's corrosive of democratic deliberation.
Well, then you'd say that public media has become even more important in the last.
Absolutely. Now, that's not to say public broadcasters of the old form. Where clearly the audience is declining over time. Whether we still have broadcasting in 10 or certainly 20 years, I think, is a moot point. But public service, in the sense that the endeavor of creating media that serve our interests as citizens, not just as consumers. So not just the entertainment thing, or the distraction thing, but
Okay.
the educative and the informative function, the
Okay,
creation of a
Peter.
community that
Thank you.
understands each other.
Thank you for coming on board and having this discussion about the necessity of having a broad public media and
Absolutely.
support for it.
Public media on every platform for everybody. I think that's what we need.
Okay, thanks a lot, Peter.
Thanks, Marvin. Great to be on your program
See
again.
you.
Kia kite. Bye for now.
Okay, bye.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.